have different levels. Here's a brief introduction, Phil. So Phil, who goes by the pen name Paul Constant, was one of the first folks I personally had ever met who'd had a realization. Phil was there at the first retreat that I attended. And what I appreciate about Phil is his genuine kindness towards people and the earnestness with which he listens to spiritual seekers. And he shares his perspectives. So, in addition to being the creator of searchwithin.org, which is, a treasure trove of resources for people interested in this stuff, sincere spiritual seekers, Phil also co-hosts retreats or sittings at TAP Foundation events and has authored numerous articles in the TAP forum. So I want to end this introduction with a quote from Phil. Phil writes, "I offer this bit of encouragement to fellow seekers. You think you might not have what it takes. By all means, doubt what others might tell you about the truth, but believe in your own ability to see." So, with that, Phil, I want to start off with a question for you. Richard Rose's name has already come up a few times today, from Hugh and from Mike and from others. So, can you tell us what you learned from your time with Richard Rose and maybe how key takeaways from him or lessons learned from him informed your own spiritual path?
Yeah, well, thanks everybody for coming and thanks for having me here. So when I met Richard Rose, we were talking the other day when we were preparing for this. I was 22, and it was 40 years ago, almost 40 years ago. And of course, Benji and Brett both said, "Well, that was the year we were born." And they also said, "We aren't spring chickens." So it was quite a long time ago, and he was in his upper 60s when I met him, so there was quite a difference in age between me as a fledgling seeker and the wisdom that comes with age, which I now see that happens in my life naturally. But I know somebody here mentioned they were a solo seeker, and I was too. I had started reading books in my late teens and stumbled across Richard's Rose's book, The Albigen System, and it caught fire in me. And I read all of his books in about a year. And then he invited me to the farm for an event. And I was extremely introverted. I was really just an uncomfortable person in my own skin and very much in my head. But that was the first, what I, getting my nose out of the books was the first step. And that was true action to get out of my house and go to his farm at an event where fellow seekers were in attendance. So it's kind of hard to encapsulate what he did for me in, in a 5-minute nutshell, but I could feel the man's energy. I knew he was a straight shooter, which to me is extremely important for a teacher. And I also know he never asked anything of me, which again, I think is an important characteristic of a teacher. He didn't ask for money, he didn't ask for anything. And so, yeah, I was a solo seeker and I went to see him. Personally, I could care less about the other people in attendance because I thought this guy knew and had what I wanted, and the others did not. But I came to learn that some of my greatest teachers were the friends that were there at the TAP meeting. And one of the things Rose instilled in me was the value of friendship on the spiritual path and working with others who might be on a rung of the ladder above us, those below us, those on the rung adjacent. And yeah, so working with others certainly was an important aspect of Rose's teachings. And there's just so much he did to inspire me to keep going. And certainly one of the things was application of energy. I remember being around him, and I know the other students would say the same thing, that he was so determined and expressed his determination to find truth. I always felt inadequate, like I could not match that man's determination. But I showed it over time, my commitment with traveling to his farm, not just for TAD events, but just to meet him, to meet the other students living on the farm. And yeah, that was a start in 1985. And he was around for about 10 years before he started to fade with Alzheimer's. And it changed my life. I mean, there was just, again, it's kind of hard to encapsulate all his teachings in a short presentation, but that's kind of it. Those are the highlights.
Thanks, Phil. Yeah, I want to come back to in a little bit. I want to come back to what you mentioned about friendship with other seekers, but I kind of wanted to start a little bit earlier than that and kind of ask you, because you kind of have an interesting seeker story. So I just kind of want to ask, what made you want to seek in the first place? Like, what was wrong that you were trying to solve, that you were reading philosophical books and going to this guy's farm in West Virginia? Like, what made you so committed? What were you trying to fix or achieve? It's pretty against the grain.
Yeah, I would think the largest aspect or largest motivation for me, there was just something in my heart that wanted to know truth, that wanted to know reality. And I was just fascinated, consumed by something larger than me. And I wondered what Richard Rose exuded in his personality and in his teachings. And of course, in my early 20s, there was a desire to perfect my personality. There was things about me that I just had an aversion to certain aspects of myself. As I mentioned before, I was very introverted, and R Rose was anything but introverted. He was my opposite, and I wanted to learn. And I've heard other students say this. I never thought of it until they said it, but I wanted to learn to be a man. I was in my early 20s, and he just had some wisdom as going through life. And then, of course, he had spent a lot of time with students and working with students. And I thought he had the skills as a teacher that would help me. So there were things lacking in me, to answer your question, but there was also this deep, deep desire and curiosity to know what the score was, what reality was.
So, Phil, how did that affect, do you think, the way your life unfolded? Do you feel you made different choices, or it's impossible to know how things could have worked out, but what can you say about the course that set you on, or what difference that made for you?
Well, I was I feel like one of the to me, this in my opinion, the key ingredients is to commitment to the truth, commitment to reality, to finding reality. And so, at that time in my life, or early 20s, that's a time for romping and fun. And I curtailed that to a great degree. I didn't eliminate it, but I sacrificed in some ways when I was instead of on weekends and work all week. Friday would come along, I'd roll out of work and travel 3 or 4 hours to Rose's farm and spend the weekend there, and then leave Sunday afternoon to go back home. So how did it change my life? I think what I would say is I made it a top priority. But it wasn't, I feel like it's that should not may be made at the sacrifice of like a good relationships with family and friends. It shouldn't be, a scorched earth approach. So I did make it a priority, but it was just a little bit more of a priority than other things in my life, getting ahead of work or just running out and having fun. I've said this in a couple of talks I've given. My life just took on the spiritual search was a gravity around which my life revolved. It was the core gravity for me.
Bill, you in a different interview that you did on Sean Nevin's podcast, you talked about you sort of you were very in your head, and then there was a second element for you where it was very much like the opposite, like you had to go to the feeling, or I don't want to put words in your mouth, maybe intuitive side or the love side. Can you talk about why you think there was like such a, one polar opposite and the other, or and why they, what happened there? What caused the flip?
Well, if anybody listens to me talk long enough, they'll see that I advocate balance. And I'm not saying that this was during my path, but in retrospect, I can now see the balance of the two between logic and intellect and feeling love, the heart side. So, I'll take a page out of Bill's book because I always have to give him credit for this quote. I was the Tin Man and the Wizard of Oz. I had no heart, and but I was still sensitive. I was sensitive to perceiving things from other people and whatnot. But somebody mentioned Jacob's Ladder. And Ian Rose's Psychology of the Observer. And to me, that is like a core roadmap to realization. And it's very appealing to the logical side of me that there is this process of retreating within in a way to know thyself, to watch the intuitive side and to watch the rational side. Both in the way our mind works and using those two tools, we can know thyself in a way that otherwise we drift through life in a dream. And so I don't like to talk about my realization all that much because it can kind of give a, I don't know, an impression on the way things need to be, but just with the understanding that this is unique to me, what Rose's system did in following Jacob's ladder and in retraversing the ray of creation and the rear specter was it came to the point where my mind stopped and I essentially disappeared into nothingness. So being so mind-oriented, so logical-oriented, it was a shock to see, despite all I had heard about realization, that I did not exist. And it was an experience of dissolving into nothingness, into complete emptiness, into true nature, into the absolute. But I came out of that, and I still doubted, like, that what I saw essentially was so simple, and everything that I had been searching for because of the way my I was wired was this was supposed to be something grand and complex in realization, the state of enlightenment going through life. Well, it wasn't. It was very simple, and what I had been looking for had been there all along. But I had to I felt still half-baked, I used to say, and I felt like I needed something else. So I got the nothingness side of the equation, but I needed to understand or experience what people were talking about, the everythingness. Now, you know, you can look at the absolute and say it's unbounded, and therefore it is everything. It's timeless, eternal, and again, without edges. But there was just something nagging at me. So I continued to seek, and actually continued, because Rose had disappeared out of the scene. I think I was in my early 40s at the time I had the realization that I mentioned. And it wasn't until 6 or 7 years later, I was actually going to meditation retreats, that my heart opened, and it opened in an enormous way. People talk about chakras. I'm not really that well versed in chakras, but my heart literally exploded outward, and I felt it in a retreat. And that started this fire of to just consume me. It was love. It was, when people talk about a bhakti side of the equation, I had no idea what they meant. I was like, falling in love with the teacher? That's absurd. I would never fall in love with Richard Rose. Well, he wasn't the teacher to show me that side of it. And I did fall in love with the teacher, and it was a completely non-physical relationship. And that just showed me, ultimately, my love was projected on the teacher, but the love that when it was depersonalized was, it just showed me the everythingness side of this reality. So maybe that's unique. I do think other people have that experience where they might have an experience of everythingness and nothingness comes later, or vice versa. But it does feel like, to me, it took time to settle in. And then all those doubts that I had are gone. So in the end, you know, I tell my wife, she says, why do people seek? I said, there is no utility value other than my heart, which ached so deeply for reality, the heartache is gone. So that's all I had to say about that, but I can answer more questions if prompted any.
So Phil, that's kind of like the happy ending. I mean, it may not be that simplistic, but it's certainly a nice feeling to have that heartache taken away. But I've read, you know, from what it sounds like, but I've read that you say that in retrospect, you failed your way to the truth. And stretches where you felt you weren't really serious. And what was that like? Why do you say you failed your way to the truth? And what was the path like on a day-to-day basis leading up to those moments you just described?
Well, when I use that term, I failed my way to truth, that started when I was in my 20s, when I started seeking. And what I mean by that is I tried pretty much everything that Richard Rose advocated. And he has a lot of wisdom in his books and in his audio recordings. And I just applied everything I could possibly think at. He used to use the term, throw enough mud at the ceiling and some of it will stick. And that's what I tried. But everything that I seemed to try did not do the magic trick. And I could see, you know, I know there's disagreements in the various teachers who ultimately get to the point to say, in looking back, if they're realized that there's nothing to be done, you can't do anything because what you're looking for, you already are. Well, that's true, but it took for me a hell of a lot of sledgehammers and scalpels to peel away the onion, so to speak, and those sides of myself by staring at myself, you know, through self-observation. through awareness, through the process observer that Rose would talk about, to peel back that onion, those layers of self, to reveal what is, what we are. So I've heard, I know one of the teachers that I was with in a retreat would say, his teacher would say, you got to dance and dance and dance with the truth until you run out of energy to dance and you fall to the floor exhausted. And then finally, what you were looking for is revealed. I do have one caveat with that. I know I got this from Rose, but it turned out to be true for me, was in my first realization in the community building where I died, more or less, the death gene in us, or the survival urge, I should say, is not something you give up. You can't willingly give up. You can look at everything else in your life and give up and see that it's not true. But that survival urge is so ingrained in us that it will fight to the end, to the very end, to not let go. And I realized I had prayed for help. I prayed for anything, anybody to help me as this realization was winding up. And I realized at that point that I can't do it myself. And something, I feel, stepped in and took the survival urge away, the fear that I was feeling for fear of death. So all those things I mentioned, with the very last thing, except being the exception, the survival urge, was all failures.
Bill, I had a kind of a related question. What you just said reminded me, from what I understand, Rose used to say, you know, make yourself accident prone. Basically saying, like, awakening's an accident, but make yourself accident prone. What could you talk about what you did to, you know, to what you think might have, we can't know for sure, but what do you think made yourself open to that grace or unseen force? What do you think it was that you were doing or not doing? Or
it was my lifelong pursuit of applying energy to see myself more clearly. You know, working with others on a spiritual path, working with teachers to a certain degree. If you wish, I can go into what I think might be important for other people, which of course is going to be based on, you know, what I did myself. I wouldn't advocate anything for others that I didn't feel like I had done myself, and in some way they were a service in making me accident prone.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't know what ultimately cracks the head open, so to speak, for any one person. But so I did take some time to what I think, what I would give as advice based on things that I did. So one of them is, I mentioned a commitment to this, to reality, to the search. I feel in a practical way, setting aside a time every day. Just every teacher I've ever studied with said, set aside some time every day to that is devoted to your spiritual path in whatever way that might be. And I feel like one of the better ways for me was to maybe read a little bit and then sit and do some self-inquiry or do some meditation. But I feel like it's important to carve out either 30 minutes or an hour, whatever the time is you can afford, and make that part of your day. And in some way, that's a huge statement to your life, to just be able to say, I want truth, and I'm willing to carve out time to make it happen. And then I would say we talked about different ways that people can go about this, but look for tools based on your conversations with fellow seekers, things that they've tried, and teachers to go within. To I talked about the retroversing your ray of creation, and a way to do that, even though what we are looking for, I can say, is here. It's in every person. There's nothing special about me, but there's a way to go about this to see yourself more clearly and to know thyself. And you have to find what works for you. But studying the mind with the mind, looking at yourself for something, a step within. If you follow Jacob's ladder, there's a point where you're watching your mind, you're watching your feeling, you're watching your feelings and your thoughts. And then you realize there's something that's watching all of this. So, he calls it you're conscious of awareness. And that's what I mean, kind of stepping within and retroversing your ray of creation by looking at yourself and knowing thyself. And I feel in my life, meditation and self-inquiry both were vital. I spent a lot of time, thousands of hours probably, sitting on a Zafu, meditating and watching my mind, trying to figure out what made me tick. And I loved it. It wasn't a chore. So if it gets to the point where meditation becomes, unpleasant, maybe is a word, or a chore, or you think like, oh, it's an obligation, maybe that isn't the best approach. But for me, I generally loved sitting in meditation and watching my thoughts, feeling my body sensations coming into my body, and also the perceptions, sounds and things that were going on while I was meditating, but also self-inquiry, which is looking within and again finding out what makes me tick. And you can use others. In TAT, we use group inquiry, which I feel is extremely vital, because people will see things, could see things about me that I could never see myself, that I'm blind to. And that's the beauty of TAT. It's not like this group think culty group, because people are always challenging each other. It's not a bubble of, oh, you have to think XYZ. It's more the opposite. Why are you thinking XYZ? So your thinking is challenged with even group inquiry. And I used to poo-poo like Jacob's ladder. There's mind, there's body, mind, essence. And I used to poo-poo the side of the body, and it's a strategy. So I'm not the body, I'm not the mind, I am what is. But in the end, we are the mind and we are the body, and all three, essence, mind, body, are, I don't know, pure intelligence. It's life. And so the mind, even though it has a lot of perils and a lot of negative aspects to it, it is also our way to truth, doping this stuff out. And the same with the body. These aren't my words, but the body is, we are the space between heaven and earth. The body is this intricate nervous system that transforms essence to the relative, or vice versa. It doesn't matter if it's going one way or the other. But the body is obviously the key component of that. And I mentioned working with spiritual friends, you and genuinely wanting to help others, and also being open to them helping you. And working with a trusted teacher, and this is important to me, I found that teacher should prioritize your search over money, power, sex, whatever they're after. And there are plenty of stories of bad actors out there who claim to be enlightened, and maybe they are, but there's this dark side, where the teacher doesn't have the student's interest, best interest at heart. And so you have to be careful. And I feel like it's best to doubt everything that teacher is saying and prove it for yourself. And let's see, I have three left. So be honest with yourself truly and fully. I mean, that is quite a challenge. So you have to look at yourself and decide that you're not kidding yourself, you're not fooling yourself. And and then have Brett read that piece. Have faith in your ability. So, in a way, you doubt everything, but don't doubt your ability to see this through. And when you do see it, you'll look back and say, "Well, that was ridiculous, because what I've been looking for."
Like your internet froze, Phil. He was just about to tell us all the secret.
Is
That's
find
happened on some
ways.
of these other calls too. Are you there, Phil?
Yeah, did I lose you?
Yeah, we right at the big punchline, the big reveal, the secret of life. It froze up.
I saw that you guys froze, but I don't know what.
Yeah, thank you, Ricky. Ricky said it froze right at what I had been looking for, and then it.
Just at the
What
moment.
happened? Are you there?
Yeah, it looks
Okay.
like it's better now.
All right. Where did I lose you?
Ricky said it was right where what did Ricky say? What I had learned was, and then it what I had I what I had been looking for, dot dot dot.
I don't know which point it was. Sorry.
Basically, you said that you couldn't believe it was that simple. So had faith in your
Yeah.
to find it, and then, ouch, how could I have missed it almost?
Well, that's what you find. And I think I might have been relating that to having faith in your ability. Yeah, having faith in your ability to see the absolute, because you'll hear it, but I don't think it helps when a teacher says, "Well, you already are what you're looking for," because that would just be a belief. You have to find it for yourself. But in order to do that, you have to have faith in your ability. And it's ridiculous to think that there's something inadequate in me that prevents me from realizing the truth, or something awful I did in my past. God. When we talk about unconditional love, which is the absolute cannot refuse anything because it's wide open, and therefore it is ready to accept us as whatever we are, in whatever side of us feels inadequate to see. That's just not That's what unconditional love is. It accepts all. And then the last thing I had was find ways to nurture your love of truth. This is our life. It shouldn't be. It should be joyful. It should not be. The search for truth should not be some drudgery. It may feel like that at times, but I just truly had a love of truth. I wanted to know what reality was, and I wanted to be it. And so, I would just find ways to inspire myself. And honestly, I think one of the best things a teacher can do is to inspire that love of truth, to inspire seekers, rather than giving some kind of prescription or concrete formula. So those are my top whatever 9 or 10 tips.
Great. Thanks, Phil. I think that's a good pausing point for as we transition to the open Q&A. So right before we do that, we're going to just send out a quick Zoom poll. We'll take about 2 minutes if you don't mind answering. It helps us make these events more useful and figure out what TAP members and new attendees and what everybody would like to see coming up. So Brett, if you want to launch that poll and everyone, if you could fill it out, and then we'll get going with the next section.
Hey everyone, now that we've done the interview, we're going to move into the participatory session. And the way this works is basically a Q&A. So if Phil's stirred anything in you or got your gears turning, got your mind working, something you want to ask, we're going to use the raise your hand feature just to keep it a little organized. So all the way at the bottom of your screen, you'll see a kind of a smiley face with a plus sign that says reactions. And so if you click on that, you should see a button that says raise hand. And if you do that, we'll see you and we'll call on you. And we'll take it from there. Phil, does that sound all right? Are we ready for
Yeah,
that?
I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, great. So, Bill, why don't you go ahead with the first question?
So, yeah, Phil, you wrote somewhere that prior to your experience, you derived a lot from reading other people's testimonials about what they found, about their experiences. So, the question that I have is, do you feel that there are other experiences, or is there only one enlightenment?
Oh, I think I would say there are levels of awakening, and it could be something as practical as, I'll just give some examples going way back into my early 20s. So I was reading Uspensky's In Search of the Miraculous, and he talked about waking up and like a waking sleep, and that's the kind of state I was in. And I remember riding a bus to Penn State because my apartment was a couple of miles out, and I was standing in the morning, and after reading some of those books about Uspensky, I realized I suddenly had an awakening, like on the bus, that was, my God, I've been in my head deeply asleep. And I realized it was so stunning to me to know, or to see myself, just my mind whirling on, I don't even know, just day-to-day stuff. And so that was kind of an eye-opener for me. It wasn't a final awakening or anything. It was just an epiphany about how deeply asleep I was in life. And I remember reading Psychology of the Observer. I was at the apartment over the summer, and all my roommates were gone for the summer, and I just kept wanting to know, what does he mean by being an observer? Where am I on that J and it just got under my skin. And I realized at some point what he was talking about. I was able to watch my mind. I can't even tell you when in my life that was, but I realized that there was something deeper within me watching. And of course, different teachers will call it the different things, like the witness, the process, observer. I can't think of some of the other terms I've come across over the years. But that to me is like kind of an opaque taste of true self. It's kind of look, it's awareness, but it's still individualized, kind of in a cloudy glass of, but yet it's a significant step within, and we're able to watch our mind and watch our feelings. And then I knew that I was aware, and I knew I was aware that I was aware. And that also is a significant step, when we can watch our mind and know that there's this awareness that's within us. And again, that it's a rather large, significant step. And I think some people get hung up on that and maybe feel that, oh, that's it, I'm awareness, so I'm done. But there is the final step. And this is something I'm not too familiar with, but to answer your question, like, some people seem to get the sense that they are everythingness, and they are, the world is perfect. There's a sense of perfection, but they don't yet see that they don't exist. And it's only the combination of that, everything and nothingness, that is becoming or dissolving into the absolute. Now, this stuff all sounds abstract, and it is, in a way, when our mind is trying to grasp what somebody is saying about that. But on the other hand, you know, it's very ordinary. I mean, the moment of enlightenment can be very shocking. But on the other hand, living a life from that vantage point is quite ordinary. And I mentioned before, there's nothing unique about me or special about me than anybody else. You know, I'm still struggling with all the exigencies of life, and all the turds that get thrown at me that life has to offer. And you know, on the other hand, there's just this I don't know, acceptance, or there's also an extreme beauty to life itself. So I don't know if I answered your question. I'm not super versed in all the levels that people talk about with their realizations, but I do know, having been around a number, and I'm not talking about people within TAT, having listened to a number of teachers, I've heard them say, oh, you're not as deeply as realized as I am. Which is ridiculous. But I guess maybe they have something to sell, and maybe that's where they're coming from. I don't have anything to sell. I don't have a book. I don't ask anything from anybody, but maybe a thanks for a little bit of time. I do it because I love the truth and want to help other people any way I can to maybe see true nature.
Thank you.
Thank you, Phil. Mark?
Yeah, hi, Phil. Actually, what you were talking about is a good segue to my question, in that it seems like a lot of people do experience the nothingness separately from the everythingness. And so I have kind of two questions about that. One is that, is everything this kind of the equivalent of what some people call universal oneness or cosmic consciousness even? And the second part of that is, it seems like the nothingness and everythingness, until they're sort of combined, like you mentioned, up until that point, it's all still relative.
Well, again, I don't know what people were talking about when they say cosmic consciousness or awareness in the way they're describing it. So what I could tell you is, it felt like when I emptied out, I can interpret that to be everything. When you see that you are empty and boundless, it has no edges, that could be construed as awareness unbounded into everything. But I think there has to be, it took, in my experience, there it took time to acknowledge that the relative, the world of the relative, is also part of the absolute. So yes, there is true nature, and there is an absolute from the standpoint of pure awareness, one awareness. But there's also this other thing that I mentioned, which is life, which is consciousness. And it's a deep understanding that the awareness and the relative are merged. I'm almost sounding like something grandiose, but that is what I mean by it's an ordinary existence after understanding true nature and kind of coming down off the mountain and going back into the mind, back into the body, and understanding that it's the two merged together, absolute empty awareness and the world of the relative. So I'm not quite sure I answered your question, but that's kind of what I get out of when I would describe everythingness and nothingness combined is one way of describing the absolute.
Yeah. Thanks, Phil.
Mike, it looks like you're up next.
Sweet, thank you. Hi, Phil.
Hey, Mike.
You mentioned, folks, just I think in your last explanation, feeling like they've, excuse me, a sense of perfection. Did you get that feeling during, I won't even say your final realization, but during any of the realizations you may have had?
There might have been, I would say there was a sense of perfection. A person can become too attached to pure awareness. And I remember thinking, what could be more perfect than this essence that we are, that has no aspect of us in it, so to speak, this pureness. But I feel like that was probably, an attachment. It was an egoic attachment, that sense of perfection. And I feel like I needed to accept the other side of the equation when, I mentioned like the world of the relative. Well, there were things about me that I still did not like. There was an aversion to self. I think it just there's a recognition that we are all imperfect, and more of an acceptance of that, combined with the understanding that yes, our true essence is perfect. So that's my, I guess, one taste of what I would say perfection. I know other people have described like a sense of looking at life and saying, my God, everything is the way it should be. And that is true in a way. But I feel like that's and still incomplete. It's an incomplete way of looking at life.
Yeah, the reason I asked that was that I had a sense of the perfection in life, and then it didn't really stay. So, like you had also mentioned, well, hey, it can't be all this simple, right? And that was kind of the thought I had, can't be all this simple. Did you know, I mean, I remember, and this was many years ago, back at Rose's Farm, I think it was 2011, and you had described your final realization, and it seemed pretty like you would know this is it, right? Is that the case? Did you know your final realization was happening, or did you sense it like 2 days later or something when you just kind of got a grip?
I'm laughing at myself. So I hope I didn't leave that impression. As stunning as the realization was in 2007, where I emptied out, and as I call it, a metaphorical death. When I came out of that, I still doubted that was all there was. And you know, to me, it was like there was some providence that stepped in and showed me everything that I needed to see at that point. But yet, almost within an hour or two, after unequivocally knowing that I did not exist, unequivocally, there was no like skepticism in the mind at that point. But soon after, I just started to doubt. And one of it was, it can't be this simple. Everything that I've looking for had always been presenting myself. And I think everybody should have a question, like a main question theme. And mine was towards the end, near the realization, was, what is the source of my awareness? I know I'm aware. Where is this awareness? Well, the answer was, it's in my face all the time. It had always been in my face, and it can't be this simple. I'm looking around for something grand. So I do think there, you know, it might just take some time to settle into. Someone said my mind had yet and not yet fully bowed to the truth. I was exposed to the truth fully, but it just took time to ultimately bow to the truth. And that's what came a couple of years later, when there was a feeling component, a warmth and a compassion. An experience of nothingness can be cold, empty. It could seem cold and empty, but I feel like when the rest of it came later, there was a warmth and compassion and love. And you said something, by the way, a lot of people will tend to poo-poo. Everybody here, I'm absolutely sure everybody on this call has had some taste, some profound taste along the way. And the mind will tend to poo-poo it and dismiss it. And so, yes, if you've had that, don't try to repeat it. You can't like set up the circumstances to be identical to what led up to that mini realization. But to me, it's like the aperture opens a little bit. It's like the camera lens, you know, it's closed. We can't really see what's going on, but you have these mini realizations, it opens up and it feels big, and then maybe closes, but not shut again. And those tend to wear down the self over time, to the point where, you know, there's a catastrophic collapse of the mind, and the aperture never recloses fully after that.
Awesome. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Sure.
Oleg?
Hello, hello.
Hey, Oleg.
Yeah, I think in the writings that was sent, you mentioned like a couple of times, kind of like you are frustrated. Yeah, you kind of already talked about it a little bit, like you how you're frustrated with like seeing awareness and then seeing like you are aware of things, or there is awareness, and then you're like aware of awareness, and it's like two different awarenesses, like it cannot be two things at once. And it's like you had a frustration like for a long time that it's like you are switching between two plays or something like that. I maybe had something similar, but I had a thought that maybe when you are thinking that you are aware, that you are aware, are you actually aware of awareness, or are you just aware of like a concept of awareness in a way? Because like, how can you really be aware of awareness except like being aware of a concept of awareness in a way? Like, or maybe can I just tell more about like your frustration of like these 2 points of awareness? Because it's an interesting point, I think. Yeah.
Well, I go back to Jacob's Ladder as my roadmap. And so that top triangle in Jacob's Ladder, which is essence, on the one side has the process observer, which is the way Rose describes it was the mind in its maximum potential. And then it has a polar opposite, and he labels it consciousness of being conscious of awareness, which I like better than aware of awareness, because that aware of awareness implies two awareness, which is silly, because we can't be two points of awareness. So we're just conscious of the fact that there's this aspect of ourselves that, again, I would describe as kind of a cloudy, individualized ray of the absolute. We're not quite dissolved into the absolute. So at the top of that triangle, he has absolute awareness, to distinguish between the individualized awareness. And just to answer your question, I was just extremely frustrated being this guy who was all in my head, trying to dope out where this awareness was coming from. Was it in front of me? Was it out there? Or was it somewhere like back behind my head, coming through my head, not my eyes? It could feel like that. But I feel like, even though Rose talks a lot about a system of tension, I didn't artificially create tension in my life by looking for it, but I tell you, trying to figure out where awareness was, what awareness was extremely, it's just extremely frustrating. And I felt like the tension was there and I didn't know it. And in my realization, I describe it in that one piece that I wrote, Stop Looking and See. There was some ball of energy out. It felt outside of me, but it was like a crackling energy. And I feel like that, and again, this is unique to me, but I feel like that was the tension that manifested over 20 some years of my life looking. And when that flooded in, that emptied me out. And Phil was not there at that point. It was only awareness. Now something was witnessing that, and that's always a mystery. Like, who is the witness of nothingness? doesn't quite make sense. But that playing out, trying to figure out what awareness was, stopped my mind.
I think I have a similar kind of tension question: where is this awareness? And then that there is like this kind of like duality, like if awareness is all encompassing, should like be neutral and encompassing of everything, of every possible thing. Like it would be aware of like you looking for awareness to be aware of everything. Then if it's like all encompassing, then how is it still possible that there is a part of you like still like moving? It seems like it's a part apart. Yeah, like you think like, okay, I think I sense like that awareness is neutral and it's like all encompassing at the same time. Like, why am I still like, why is it still moving, like searching for something? If it's all encompassing, there should be like complete like acceptance, peace, and yet there is a part, like the second part is like moving me. Like I feel like it's like, okay, what is it, where is it, like still searching for something. Yeah, that I feel this duality. Yeah, because yeah, thank you.
Yeah, it's awareness is our umbilical cord, to use Rose's term, back to the Father, back to the truth.
Thank you, Oleg. Yerum?
Okay, yeah. Hi, Phil. My question is twofold. We met a few times, and it was after your awakening in the TED building. But the last time we met was after also, let's call it the heart opening. And I remember back then that I felt like you were a completely different man, much more approachable, much more connecting. So it seemed that that also brought changes on the level of the personality, or maybe something else happened. But I'm interested to hear your perspective on that. And also, if you notice things, how have things unfolded since then?
Yeah, well, I can only, I guess, go by what people like yourself say. And they may have, a couple years went by between us seeing each other since you're overseas. And you probably had a better perspective on me in that way that I changed in some way. I guess maybe when I saw some of the foolishness of my search, even though, it was very serious, and I feel like seeking is very serious. It felt like I was trying too hard back in those days. And there's just more of an acceptance when my heart opened, as I mentioned, it just felt like this softer side of me that was maybe hidden or covered up by the rougher sides, the rougher edges of me. Those rougher edges got shaved off, and it just feels like, I don't know, lack of a better word, might be being saturated within, kind of seeing what I had been looking for pretty much all the time. It was always there. And that softened me up quite a bit. And I think what also changed, and again, this might be unique to me, just my heart exploding in pure love. And I don't mean to use that term to, like, giddy teenage love for another person. It was quite powerful. Some ways very sad. So it's a lot, seeking involves a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And I look back on some of that. It was a lot. I gave up a lot in what I would call, the parts of life, because of my spiritual search. But in the end, I could not ask for any more of a gift than all that I've received. And despite my efforts, the God, I've said tongue in cheek, like, I had the realization, the first realization that you saw me back in 2007, and I was like a spoiled teenager. I had to go keep looking for more, and it was a good thing. But my lover was always by my side, and by that I mean, God. I went looking for something else, like a spoiled teenager, but it never abandoned me, and all I had to do was come back home. And That's when you saw the softer side of me a couple of years later, when the realization was how precious the seeking was and what had been bestowed as a result of it all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So wow. So you're continuing, you compare to a spoiled teenager. So this unfolding would also have happened maybe if you hadn't done all the meditation retreats that you did after the first awakening?
I don't think it would have happened without the continued effort between, you know, the two, what I call two realizations. But as far as life now, you know, I don't like so much talking about myself, because I think everybody's going to have a different way of this unfolding. But you know, nowadays I just love being out in nature. I love the vibes. We moved to a new home here. We're out in the woods. I have no idea why I moved, other than just now that I'm here, I look back and say, wow, you know, nature has its dark side too, but there's some vibe in life that is just amazing to me now. And I think that's just the result of just, yeah, settling into the realization of what I am, what I truly am.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks a lot for your openness and your time. Thanks, Phil.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Rob, you're up.
Thank you. Hi, Phil.
Hey, Rob.
So, lots I want to ask you, but I'm going to try and focus. You mentioned your presentation you did, and there's a recording somewhere called The Love of Truth. And in this talk, you've alluded to consciousness and awareness. I'm just going to say, do you agree that consciousness is more personal and more in the relative and more connected with the world? Whereas what I think I've heard you say is that awareness is impersonal rather than being personal, and awareness is not something we have. Awareness is what has us. And the second question I'll come back to, but I'll just let you comment on that.
Yeah, that there again, there's so many teachers and it's so accessible nowadays. You know, on the internet, you can just watch 1,000 teachers. And they all, these words are all bandied about loosely. And so I'm glad you asked this, because I distinguish consciousness. I know consciousness, people use that term to mean, you know, closer to true nature. I would term consciousness to be life, to be us, to be our whole bundle of personalities and thoughts and feelings. And so you have to, and so in using that word that way, when you're conscious of awareness, that means that self, small s self, playing itself out. There's a side of us that, you know, you get into the cosmology of this, but if God is empty and without traits, without feelings and thoughts, it needs us as a ray of the absolute, as a ray of it, to experience itself. And that's through our individualized ray of consciousness, which, you know, at the end of that ray of the absolute is us. So there's 6+ billion rays of the absolute, all sending back various messages so that God can feel itself. Now, I'm saying that in speculation. I don't know that a realization doesn't tell you that for sure. I don't even know what awareness is.
Yep.
I can't even tell you, but I know that I experience it. And you, everybody here experiences it in different ways. To different degrees. So that's what I mean. I think I answered your question about consciousness and awareness.
And again, within your diagram of Fool's Talk, you make reference to unmanifest mind, sorry, the unmanifested mind, manifesting mind, and manifested mind. I'm going to guess manifested mind is the world, what you've just called a consciousness, that unmanifest mind is the absolute. But I haven't a clue what you mean by manifesting mind.
Yeah, the manifested mind is what we perceive of the world through us, are all the sensations, the senses, the thoughts, the feelings. That's manifested. So think about that or feel it, whatever way you want. But yeah, anything in the view is not the viewer. So the view is like the shadow of Plato's cave. You know, it's manifested. It's within the view, but there's something watching, which is unmanifested, because it's seeing what is manifested. It was Franklin Merriam-Wolf calls it objects in consciousness.
Okay.
Anything that you can view.
And
so don't get too caught up on that.
No. That's very helpful. That's very helpful.
Good.
And the final one relates to something I said right at the beginning, about after getting into the body and then realizing there's a need to go back into the body. So do you imply, I think, that you're living a very physical, visceral life?
Of course, yes. There's the realization doesn't. Well, yeah. In fact, I think it's important to stay grounded. I think I've seen some teachers a bit too airy, what I call like too much up here. I feel like the body is like a grounding rod, like a lightning rod. You know, you're taking this energy of the absolute, and it's the body is a grounding mechanism. And I feel like from a practical level, I know physical exercise is very grounding to me. Even a good meal is very grounding. Like I can feel myself getting kind of spacey and up too much up in my head. So even on like spiritual retreats, you know, I used to go for, if there was a break in the sitting for the meditation, I'd always go for a walk just to get myself grounded. And because I've been sitting, thinking and feeling too much in meditation. So it's vital that they're all balanced, and they'll always keep that in perspective, body, mind, essence.
Thank you.
So this is a good point, just to interject. The official end time of this event is now. Phil mentioned to us that he'd be willing to stick around for a little while afterwards, but we just wanted to make sure we honor the end time if anyone has to leave. You know, we wanted to thank Phil for taking his time so far and any other time that he'll take with us. And thanks to everyone who attended and asked questions and listened. Thanks to the TAT trustees and the officers, and of course, all the members. Just some quick announcements before we get back into, you know, extra time with Phil. Phil, is that still okay? I should ask.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Now. Oh, okay. There will be an in-person TAT meeting in June. So we hope to see you there. The featured speakers are Norio Kushi and Eshwar Segobind, and also Tyler Matthews. So that should be really good. The next TAT talk will be in July on a date TBD. And we always say, if you'd like to suggest a future speaker, please email us at vicepresident@TAT Foundation, and we'll drop that in the chat. And yeah, thank you, because this is actually the year anniversary of the first TAT talk, which was last May with Art Tickner. Also, just in general, you can find more info at tatfoundation.org, and we'll drop that in there too, about upcoming events, the TAT forum, TAT's YouTube, which is, we're adding more and more content there, the TAT members only section, which is even more content that's on the YouTube. Make sure you check that all out, and make sure you sign up for email updates. So with that being said, I think we can jump. Thanks again for attending, everyone, if you have to go. And if you want to stick around, Phil, there are a few more questions. So I guess we'll go ahead, Jonathan.
Let me, I would
Go ahead, Phil.
Next question. I just want to read something that I thought to.
Oh, please.
To bring to the meeting today, and it's from Richard Rose, and I thought this is the kind of things that he would say in his books or in his talks that just made me want this at all costs. And so I think I read this back when I first bought the Elvigen papers, and it really just sparked something in me. So he said the third step, and of course you'll have to read the Elvigen papers to get the first two steps, but he said the third step involves a conscious effort to retroverse a projected ray. It does not involve the reversal of the projection from the absolute. It is impossible to reverse that which is or is the final reality. We can only reverse the forces of nature, because nature is the part of the relative worldview, which, being relative, automatically possesses negative characteristics. So I have used the picture of peering back into the focus of the projector as the final step of being one with the absolute. Actually, we go back in one sense, and at the same time, we find that we are back there all the time. And so, you know, that was his system of reverse, what he called the reverse vector, which is, you know, a vector is a direction. And instead of defining God or defining the absolute, we have to back away from, as he puts it, the forces of nature, that which is in the view, and those aspects of small s self. And we do that by looking. But what I found really intriguing was when he said, we go back in one sense, and at the same time, we find that we are back there all the time. And that is so true. That is what I realized and had come to accept, that everything that I had been looking for had been there the whole time. But it did no good for Rose to tell us that, because it would have been a belief. So you have to find, you have to dig and find for yourself what is meant by that. So that's all I wanted to read there.
Thanks, Phil. We can keep some questions going. Jonathan, I see your hand up next.
Hi. Thanks, Phil.
Hey, Jonathan.
Hi. Yeah, I'm going way back to the mundane, the simple, the first rung of the ladder. And Mike, when you were talking at the beginning about practice and the 10 points, I think it was that you brought up, the time that you set every day, it seemed like you talked about two parts, meditation and then self-inquiry. But correct me if I'm wrong, but I was wondering if meditation, what you meant was that settling into the noticing of your body and the feelings and all the things that are arising. When you were answering Rob's question about consciousness, that which is arising right now and passing away, how did you practically go about that for you? You know, in your day, you come in from all the stuff that's happening, and now you're going to sit down and you're going to begin. Could you talk about that?
Well, our life and our spiritual path are not separate. So life is throwing at you everything that you need to see in a time of meditation. And I just described for you like what I used to do. I try to sit in the morning first thing. I try to do 30 to 45 minutes, because I felt then that time, you know, coming out of sleep, pretty much I'd come out of sleep, maybe have a cup of coffee and then sit. And then mm-hmm. that inner looking carried through the rest of the day. Mm-hmm. So it set kind of the pattern of the day in motion. And there's different ways of meditating, and you can get into a lot of arguments about what the right way is. But mm-hmm. I say, listen to the experts and figure out what appeals to you, and then make it your own. Like, make it your own meditation practice that resonates most with you and is most productive. So I, even before I sat back in my 20s and 30s, I used to come home from work and go for a walk. So I knew mm-hmm. that time was always going to be a time for inner reflection, like what's going on in my life? What am I thinking of right now? And another way to meditate is, I want to think about a problem, an emotional issue that I'm dealing with, or, you know, some negative circumstance in life. And I want to think about that and nothing else. So when another thought arrives that is not part of that thing that I decided I wanted to think about, I just turn my head away mm-hmm. from that and continue to go back to, you know, what I intended to spend the meditation period on. So there is plenty of fodder. There should never be a lack of, like, sitting down for meditation and saying, oh God, you know, how am I going to spend the next half hour? There's always something there that is in our face that we're dealing with in life. But
right. So, oh, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. No, I just feel like the most important thing is to mm-hmm. to know thyself, and to know that you're watching, and that you know there's something beyond even this stuff in my consciousness that, you know, you always have that in the back of your mind. Like, I want to know mm-hmm. who it is that's looking. So go ahead.
Yeah, it's just a follow on that. When you'd sit after you had your coffee and you sat in the morning, did you, in those times, enter quickly into the process observer state, where did you engage in any practice? You know, there's various ways, I guess, observing the breath or anything like that to help settle the mind, become still, so that the process observer came more up, came more continuous. If that makes sense. This is kind of a practical question, but I want to know if that's how it was for you, or could you say?
Yeah, I think the advice of one teacher who just said in the first couple of minutes to get anchored, and I would just breathe, feel the breath in my diaphragm. I'd breathe from down there and maybe count backwards from 10 to 1. And just do that a few times, just to settle in a bit. And then, you know, the practice of just watching, and mm-hmm. then also being aware that there's this silence between thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And, you mm-hmm. know, that's a truer aspect of ourself, that silence. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
So, yeah, there's some practical things. Just make mm-hmm. it your own.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks, Phil.
Sure.
And you can go ahead.
I was going to ask, is there a brand of Zafu that you would endorse? But
leave it down. I have one for sale. Mine's for sale. It has rocket fuel because I sat on it for 5,000 hours.
rocket fuel meaning beans. But anyway, I guess what's coming to mind is, you know, there's a few different ways that you said that. That the truth was sort of always there in front of you. You know, you mentioned like the teenager who's like off looking, but it's like right there. You mentioned sort of retroversing the ray in some way. You were always back there. You know, sort of what's what's in front of me all the time is a mental experience. You know, it's just this experience that the mind is creating. Sort of how, I guess, like, I mean, is anything in front of me not a mental experience? You know.
Well, your sensations, your experience, your the tactile sensation on your skin, your vision, your hearing, your taste, those do not involve a layer of mind on top of it, interpreting it. It's just happening. And I would quickly add, I know I'll have a disagreement very in short order with spiritual teachers who say, I have no thoughts, and because I have no thoughts, I am more realized than you. Well, I find that my thoughts lead to a lot of resolution in life. Like I think about things, and that's the way of being creative to solve problems, whether it be finances, all the stuff that goes wrong in my house, or other things in life. So thought is not necessarily an enemy, and I would never advocate going to war with your thoughts to obliterate, you know, all thinking. Now there's a lot of just wasteful thought. It's a wasteful energy. It's, you know, self-criticism and negativity, and just letting some things in life stir us beyond what's warranted. So did I answer your question?
I guess so. Yeah, it sounded like I mean, I guess what I hear is sort of like what Bob Sergal sometimes says, of just like observe, just basically pay attention to what you're experiencing, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, an expression of love is, what do you give your attention to? Like, what do you devote your, you have an amount, finite quantity of attention every morning when you wake up, a finite quantity of energy. So what do you devote your day to? If you want to devote it to self-criticism, or, you know, just unproductive thinking, I would call it, then that's may not be the best use of that quantum of energy that we wake up with. But if you give it your attention to your family, your friends, your children, your pets, you know, things that you love, then to me, that's a wiser use of the energy and the thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, what comes to mind also is, you mentioned that the body being some sort of intermediary between heaven and earth, in a way.
You can't go through life as a empty ball of nothingness. I mean, I used to think that I had this idea that, you know, in the state of enlightenment was some state of complete emptiness, and you know, I would not have to deal with the everyday problems of life. But just by being in, yeah, the very nature of the body, it transforms nothingness to everythingness, or if you want to put it the other way, everythingness into nothingness, or everythingness, so that the God or the emptiness could feel itself. So the body is yeah, I didn't go into it too much, but one of Rose's, of course, key advice to us young fellows was to be celibate. And there is using the body to transform energy that could have been expended in sex to higher thinking by conserving. And he didn't mean you do this for your entire life. He just said, try it as a tool, one of the tools, and that's using the body to transmute, his word he used, this energy that could be used for coarse purposes into something subtler and into higher thinking. And of course, he was trying to make us more intuitive, because men tend to be, in general, more up in their head. and more logical. So he was trying to soften us up by improving our intuitive abilities through celibacy. So there's a really good practical way of the body being a tool for a spiritual seeker.
I figured I had to add a female voice to this totally male question.
Well, thank you.
But no, I really, really enjoyed. I loved your whole thing. I don't know that I've ever heard your. Anyhow, it just hit me new. It's all new, anyhow. But what I really appreciated was, you know, the stages. You know, because I'm definitely not awoke. You know, there's definitely an ego here. There's that self, and you know, my heart, I don't experience. I've had glimpses of the unitive experience, you know what I mean, of that oneness of being, but yeah, that's not my reality, that's not my daily experience. And so I really appreciate what you were sharing about how, you know, it can happen in stages and different for all of us. I heard Adi Shanti say something about that too, and I really liked that. And so I'm just kind of giving you feedback. I don't have a question, unless of course you know how to tell me that you could zap me and I'd be done. Especially on the heart level, I'd love that, because that's where it's nice and that's where the feeling comes in, right? I don't need to wake up on the gut level. I like myself, right? I like being a separate self, so I'm not waking that level, but. You know, the empty mind, I get that, you know. I think I was born with a process observer perspective. I've always watched myself as, you know, that's just what I do. And it wasn't until I was like a lot older that I realized other people don't. But to them, that's not, I just always thought that's just the way people are. So it was kind of foreign to me that's not the way all people are. It's still hard for me to conceive that people don't have the ability to put themselves in front of themselves.
Well, you're wired, you know, we're all wired differently. And so you too, it doesn't mean that, you know, you have to have this grand heart opening in order to, or you have to, you know, experience some deep feeling of love in order to realize your true essence. I'm not going to think that's some.
I don't know. I think
unique to each person.
I think what you said was true. I think that you do need to open on all levels, the heart and the mind and the, you know, no self. Otherwise, it's not the whole picture. You know, it's not, I don't feel like I have the whole picture. Because it, you know, like you said, you can't be just a ball of emptiness. You know, emptiness doesn't move. It doesn't do anything. It takes all of it, right? And of course there is all of it, but not in this perspective yet. So I guess I did have one question about the movement in there. And I liked what you said about having, you know, so for me, there's always been so much self-judgment. You know, I'm not, you know, the self-doubt, the self-hatred, non-acceptance of self, you know. And at my old age now, it's finally starting to fall away a little bit, you know. But I was wondering if before you had that opening, did you notice any movement there? Do you know what I mean? That, and I remember Tess once saying that it was that at the end of that. That she realized it was self-acceptance that she had to get, you know, and I just kind of wanted to think to you about that or ask you about that.
Yeah. These questions are good from that standpoint. I had a lot of aversion to self. Like I was, that this is a tricky part. When you start looking at yourself on this path in what, you know, I just spoke about the Jacob's ladder, looking within, you start to see things about yourself that are very uncomfortable. And you think, my God, I'm not doing this right, or I'm going the wrong way. because I'm seeing a lot of stuff that I don't like about myself. And I had that. I call it aversion to self. And it was definitely deeply embedded, and it was extremely uncomfortable. But I feel like the more grounded I got in awareness, the watching, the more that became concrete, the stronger I became in being able to accept things about myself that maybe a couple of years before that I would not have accepted, or really would have destabilized me. So the more grounded you get in this watching, and you start to see things about yourself and you don't like, you think, yeah, I'm not doing this right. This is not what that teacher is talking about. Well, it is. And it's like just seeing the dark side of, we all have the dark sides, you know, nothing, not a page out of the Star Wars, but there's a dark side within that is uncomfortable. So yeah, aversion to self was very strong. And the other thing was self-doubt. Even though Rose said doubt everything except your ability to see this through, I just still felt like, oh, there's something wrong with me. I'm not capable of a realization. So I still had that self-doubt there. And that seems to be that I've heard other, I think Adya Shanti even said that tends to be the last thing to go. And it was for me. At the very end, I realized that I am the absolute, and the doubt just dissipated, or it went away. It was no more uncertainty, or no more doubt. Doubt is a two-edged sword. It's really good when you're evaluating spiritual systems and teachers. That is crucial, but also then at the other edge of the sword cuts in, because then we start to doubt ourself. And so you realize there's things about me that that are they're a bit comical, but they are flaws. But in certain circumstances in life, they are crucial to resolving certain things. So we all have that. Like, we all have flaws, but under certain circumstances, that rises to the occasion, and man, it becomes, you know, an asset that other
Right.
people in the room might not have. So you
Right.
know what I mean. Yeah. So yeah, we all have that.
Yeah. I had one more question and then I'll be quiet. So I was thinking about, so that's the one thing. It's like, it just seems like that's crucial. And then on the other level of awakening is the doership, this that whole sense of, so which I think is the terror part, you know, that you said that you were saying, like, it's the last thing that to not be, you know what I mean? To, well, not to not be, but that you know, the survival of the ego, the survival of the separateness. Like, when did that, like, how did that, I guess that was the one part that was slain. That's what you said. That just, you can't do nothing with that. That's going to stay there till it's taken from you.
Right,
Okay.
because there's a good example. Like, it's great, it's vital that we try to resist death at all costs. Everything in life is programmed that way,
So,
but the
but
mind.
did, okay,
Okay,
I'm sorry. But
no,
did
go
it have
ahead.
a sense of doership with it? Because I hear a lot of
Yeah.
people say, oh, there's no doer here. And I have a sense of doership. I feel like I'm doing things.
Yeah.
Now, I don't feel like I have a lot of free choice. I feel like I'm running by conditioning and what my mind is telling me. But I still feel like, you know, you know, so I don't know when that sense of doership leaves.
Well, I mentioned at the very beginning, if you talk to me long enough, I speak more about balance. And so I feel like there is a doer, but also recognizing that a lot of stuff happens without us. So I think you
Okay.
have to act in life as if you can make things happen, including your spiritual realization. And but also recognizing on the other, there's two sides of the coin, you know, that maybe you're not doing anything at all.
Right. Yeah, you're not separate. So, Anyhow, thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your perspective more than you know, because like it just helps me because I feel like I can relate.
Yeah, I'm glad you joined us.
Thank you.
Bill, the other day you mentioned that your cutoff was 2. I don't know if that's changed, but I just wanted to let you know that we're about 2 minutes from 2. But if you want to keep going, you're more than welcome.
Well, I'll offer if anybody wants to have a Zoom, personal Zoom, I'm always glad to do that. You can reach me by going to searchwithin.org, and there's a link, contact the webmaster. So that's webmaster@searchwithin.org, and we can exchange some emails. I'm not too big of an email fan because I spent 30 years in state government on email, probably the last 20 years, every day in, day out. So I'm kind of burned out on that, but it's a good communication, exchange. And then I love talking more on Zoom, so then maybe we can schedule a Zoom session. So I'd offer that up to anybody if they have burning questions. Or come to a TAP meeting. I won't be there in June, but come to a TAP meeting, and then I really love seeing people face to face. I'm not a Zoom person, but yeah, I like to feel the person, not physically, but in a spiritual sense. And that happens in person for sure.
Thank you, Phil, and thank you, everyone, and hope to see you at a TAT event in the near future, in person or online.
All right. Yeah, thank you everybody for coming. Thanks, Brett. Thanks, Benji.
Take
Yes,
care.
thanks, Brett
All
and Benji.
right.
And thank you, Phil. Have a good
You're
week,
welcome.
everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks, Phil.